Hello, it's Andrew from Exo Capital, and this week I wanted to talk through a few common deal structures. So, jumping right in, the most straightforward go-to is an all-cash offer. You do all cash. It's usually 100% into an escrow account. Typically, you'll come up with some kind of structure to say maybe release 50% before the asset transfer and 50% after the asset transfer is complete. Asset transfers are a little bit more difficult to do inside of escrow.com. Typically, when you go into their UI, and I haven't been in there in a while, I actually really don't like escrow.com. They make everything a pain in the ass, like validating your LLC and all that stuff has almost always caused delays for us. But they're typically known for domain transfers. So in an ideal escrow scenario, the seller is putting the assets like a domain into an escrow.com account, right? So you transfer the domain to escrow.com. And the buyers are putting the money into escrow. And so escrow.com has all of the assets. They have the like dollar amount in there, and then they also have the actual asset that you're buying. But that's really hard to do with a software acquisitions because some of the stuff's in GitHub. I don't really want to send all the I don't even know how you would do this, like a zip file of some kind into escrow.com. Maybe they have GitHub support now. But anyways, there's generally speaking just too much crap to throw into escrow.com. So generally speaking, somebody puts 50% of the assets into escrow.com or all of the assets into escrow.com. You then just send the buyers directly all the stuff, and then yeah, once like all of the assets have been transferred, then they can then release the cash. And then there's usually like a day or two where everybody's just reviewing stuff, making sure you didn't forget anything. And then the other half of the purchase price can be transferred. And that's really it. You pay escrow.com a fee. I think acquire.com now waives the escrow fee if it's above a certain dollar amount, or maybe they always waive it if you go through there, but acquire.com charges a 4% fee themselves now. So anyways, if you're trying to save some cash, we oftentimes for smaller deals just don't do escrow.com if we have some degree of trust in the buyer or the seller. We're going through a sale right now, which is why I'm kind of talking through it from the other side of the table. But yeah, if there's a high amount of trust, and typically if somebody's based in the US, it would be unwise for them to kind of mess around with some of this stuff. It'd be too easy to show fraud and all that kind of negative stuff. Anyway, so we have a comfort level of doing small deals without escrow.com to save on the fees, but for larger ones or when we're using investor money, we definitely always use something to protect them. The second most common type of deal structure is including some kind of seller financing. So despite all of the BS on Twitter, nobody's going to say yes to, or I mean, if they do this deal, right? But if somebody says yes to like 80 or 90% seller financing over like 2 years or something ridiculous like that, that's just not the reality. I mean, put yourself in the seller's shoes. Like, okay, I'm going to hand over this asset, but actually only get like the recurring revenue that I would normally get, less expenses, of course. So maybe an extra couple grand. And then I still have to wait for a year or two to get all my money. Like that's a bad deal for the seller, which is why most people say no to that. But a common deal is 80% cash and then maybe 10 to 20% seller financing. So 80 to 90% cash, 10 to 20% seller financing, with generally speaking, no interest rate over 1 to 2 years. We don't do anything over 1 year as a seller. And as a buyer, of course, we push for more time, right? Because that's favorable to us. You as the buyer can push for 0% interest, right? You don't want to pay any interest if you're the buyer. And if you're the seller, of course, you could push for some nominal interest rate. But we usually end up doing 1 year, maybe 20% seller financing and 0% interest rate. That's typically how that shakes out. Debt, every time I post about debt and SBA loans, I get like 10 different messages from a bunch of different bankers saying, you're an idiot. This is how this is done. We do this, 10 ways to Sunday. And most of the time, we've called them or tried to get a deal through those exact people, and they can't get it done. So we've tried 3 times to get an SBA loan on just a normal SaaS acquisition. And one of them failed because the guy who was selling the business used it. It was like his own, it was just his own like LLC. So he had some ad backs in there, right? Like he was running stuff not necessarily strictly for the business. They were legitimate business expenses, right? But you have to add those back into the P&L. That can affect like how much we could take a loan out against the business because that would affect like how much actual cash we would get, like the SDE, the seller discretionary earnings. So if we took over the business and we removed his salary, we removed his, car payment, all that stuff, right? The business looked great and was great and is great still. I wish we could have bought that business, but none of these guys, none of these SBA loan gurus could make this one happen. So, and then we've tried two more times with two other deals, and the reality of trying to get some of these things through, I mean, you know, if you can do it again, good luck. Please let me know how you did it. But it's been pretty tricky. And so far we've been waiting for an incredibly squeaky clean P&L for an off-market deal with an extremely patient seller. And it's just very hard to have all of those things come together in one deal where a seller's like, oh yeah, sure. Yeah, no problem waiting like 90 days just to see if maybe, yes, you guys can buy this. No problem at all, right? Like that really doesn't happen very often. What else doesn't happen very often, or what kind of other structures we don't typically do is any kind of earnout. For doing a small deal, like under $500,000, doing some ridiculous earnout is like stupid. So small, maybe $250,000 to $500,000. I'm not going to like get in some kind of, you know, they're not even golden handcuffs. They're like copper handcuffs for 2 years to get an extra $100,000 out of a deal, and I have to go work for you. Like that is all of the earnout structures tend to be like very strange. Now, what you can do is if you are, and what I like better is some kind of churn out. So typically what really happens with these smaller deals is there's a lot of churn. They really don't have product market fit, or they do, but maybe it's kind of only one segment of the business. And so what we've structured before, and I'm still waiting for this term to catch on, is what we call a churn out. So if the revenue maintains a certain price, right, then we will pay a differing amount based on the retention. So if the MRR goes from, let's just say, if it's above 10,000, we'll buy and we'll pay 250,000 for the business. If the MRR range, as reported by Stripe or Chartmogul, be very careful about how you choose that. You might want to just do actual like bank cash collections. That might be like a way more unbiased way to do it. If the MRR range goes between 9 and 10,000, maybe we're only willing to pay 200,000. If it dips below 9,000 cash collections on a monthly basis, maybe we're only willing to pay 180,000. So we did this with Inlytics because we were worried about platform risk with LinkedIn. And it ended up helping to protect our downside a little bit and helped us sleep a little easier at night. So churnout is another way that you can do it. But earnouts, we don't really see for really small deals. It's like unrealistic to be like, oh, and then you'll get an extra $20,000 if you work for us for the next 2 years and blah, blah, blah. Equity earn-in is another piece that doesn't really come into play for us. But if you think you could grow the business and the seller also thinks you're the best person to grow the business, then the previous owner might want to keep some equity, and that way you don't have to buy the whole thing. So it'd be cheaper for you to buy, maybe less risk. You still have the previous founder, which is nice to like have to ping, because a lot of the experiments you're thinking about, they've thought about or have already run. And that can also be a nice way to grow the business and have the previous seller still involved. But again, that's not really something that we do. Especially as we're starting to take money from outside investors, our mandate is like, we got to buy the whole thing. And so it's a little weird to have like a significant equity partner that's not one of the original investors, but the previous owner. So we generally speaking don't do that. Another thing you can do is mix and match any of the above. I would just caution that things can get complicated fast, and then a confused seller, you know, is an unhappy seller. So the longer that these things take to, well, what if we, you know, if it's cloudy next Tuesday, we pay 4,000, but if it's raining, then like we'll get, you know, something like that, right? It just gets very complicated very fast, and the seller might get fatigued, and you as the buyer can also get buyer fatigue trying to like negotiate all this shit, and this deal becomes a very difficult one to make happen, and then both sides or one side ends up walking away. So I would try to keep it as simple as humanly possible. But sometimes it's necessary to bring in like a churn out, or I don't know, an equity earn in if you really want that previous seller's help or something like that. Another fun concept from negotiation is zone of possible agreement. So the buyer's range obviously tends to be lower than the seller's range. So the seller wants to sell for the highest amount. The buyer wants to buy it for the lowest amount. And that overlap, right? If there were kind of two circles, it was a little Venn diagram. That overlap between those two circles would be the zone of possible agreement. And so it's always kind of fun to keep this in mind while you're negotiating, to try and feel out what the seller's they, you know, oftentimes now on Acquire, they have their listing price. So you can say that that's maybe the top end of their desired price. But trying to, through the course of the negotiation, figure out their worst case scenario or their edge of their range that they would be willing to sell for, and see if you can find any overlap between your range and the seller's range. That is, of course, how all deals are done. So that's it. That's some basics on how we structure deals.